if you're, you know, anticipating a party or someone you're going to meet up with, you know, there's a certain sort of selection of, there's a cuisine, let's say, for those who are expecting to get some action. And then, you know, on a more relaxed day, there's things that you're allowed to eat.
Like a grilled cheese.
Like grilled cheese, yes. And fried chicken.
Yes. Okay, so it's like training for the Olympics or yeah. a marathon.
These are time-tested, you know, like gay life hacks that are being, yeah, you know.
It's wisdom.
Exactly. It's being passed down. So.
Welcome to Bitch Talk. I'm your host, Erin, here with my co-host, Ange, aka Captain Party. And over the last 10 years, we've been elevating marginalized voices through interviews and events.
Sometimes over a glass of whiskey. If you're thirsty for more bitches, head over to bitchtalkpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram.
A big thank you to 48 Hills and our listeners for voting us Best of the Bay Best Podcast in 2022 and 2023.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to our South by Southwest 2024 Film Festival coverage. Today, we're talking about two documentaries that are very dick-heavy, A House is Not a Disco and Dickweed. For both of these interviews, we're joined by our part-time festival bitch, John Wildman. Enjoy.
We are back on Bitch Talk at South by Southwest 2024. On this segment, we're going to talk about the documentary, A House is Not a Disco. My name is John Wildman, the editor-in-chief of filmsgonewild.com, guesting here with the tandem from Bitch Talk, Aaron Lim and Angela Tabora. And we're going to talk to our director, Brian J. Smith, and producer, Jeremy Truong. Okay. And Jeremy, introduce yourself so we'll recognize your voice.
Yes, hi, I'm Jeremy.
Hi guys, I'm Brian Smith.
Okay, all right, and now we always start this by having our filmmakers introduce the audience to the film. They have not seen it as yet, so tell us about House is Not a Disco.
Well, it's a fun, funny, occasionally heartbreaking community portrait of Fire Island Pines, which is a sort of queer haven about 2 hours outside of New York City. And we spent a year out there filming what their lifestyle was like and what it was like to be there, work there, play there. And sort of in the process of that, we learned a lot about queer life today.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, there's so many different storylines throughout the film. I wanted to know how you narrowed down the storylines and then why was the climate change story so important to add or leave into the film?
Well, you know, when we finished filming, we had 140 hours of footage. Oof. At the end. And I don't know, like, I would say dozens of subjects, participants, and it was a savage process of trying to figure out, you know, how do we thread all this together? Who do we spend time with? I mean, there's incredible interviews in there that we were not able to use at all. And it's heartbreaking to see those things end up on the floor. But I think once we figured out the sort of seasonal structure of the film, that we're taking the audience on a full year's journey through the place. And once we sort of like realized that the main themes were, of course, climate change, but also this idea of inclusivity and exclusivity and what it means to be yourself in a place where you can be yourself, but find yourself not being able to be yourself. Once we kind of found that through line, I think it really made sense about who we could string on that kind of clothesline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was, I think, our original intention, I think, was just to be there for one summer. And it kind of grew when we realized just how big of a difference it actually is when it's off season. And Brian's favorite time out there is always in the sort of off season, a little bit in the fall, but we were out there in the winter, and that first winter we were there, when we saw how messed up it was really and how it was affected by the storms, we realized that we had to go back out there actually to film more of it and to show more of the contrast, I think, because it kind of like, I think, gave us this perspective of like this place has like a deceptive amount of work that goes into maintaining it, and people just show up for a weekend and it's like the best weekend of their lives, and then they go home, and then like a whole crew comes in to like make sure it's clean, maintained, and still functional for, like, you know, the next group of people. So it's just really interesting, I think, for us to have spent like a year there and kind of go behind the scenes. Like, people really were very welcome to, I think, wanting to showcase that work, actually, like almost illuminate the facade slightly.
Watching this, I was very much entertained, and you know, and I've lived in New York for quite some time. Never been to Fire Island, but had a lot of friends that went to Fire Island, and I was amused, and I was looking forward to interviewing you guys to talk about this, because the personalities of your subjects here, I was like thinking, as a producer corralling them, I mean, there's herding cats and then there's corralling these guys.
Totally.
And then Brian keeping these guys on message. Like, there's one moment that I love where the two guys are contradicting each other and going, no, I don't think that at all. Well, but don't you think? No, I don't. And it's the best thing ever. So I would love for both of you to talk about from your perspectives of that.
Well, I mean, I think maybe it was more about kind of keeping me corralled, because I never went in with any sort of idea about what we were going to talk about for the most part. I really wanted these things to feel like dropped in conversations that you would have just randomly out there. We wanted to feel like the kind of experience that people have when they go out there. We wanted it to feel very, very natural. So I'm not a journalist, you know, like I'm not a, I just know when someone feels comfortable, you know, I can kind of see it in their body language. And that's what I was always looking for. And the topic of conversation, you know, sort of depended on that, if that makes sense. And then it was more about like going into the editing suite later. And by editing suite, I mean like our living rooms
and our dogs.
With our dogs and our laps. And then finding that way to thread it all together. But they were great. I really just wanted them to have a great time in front of the camera. I'm an actor. I know how scary it can be to feel like you're being recorded, especially today, where it can feel like we are just operating in a minefield. You say the wrong thing, you know, someone could, you know, take this and make you look really bad. And I wanted them to feel safe, and I wanted them to feel like they could just be themselves, and then we would take care of them.
Well, then, Jeremy, let me follow with this for you. You know, I always get the impression sometimes, because you know there's a great documentary on Studio One in West Hollywood, and there's other great, and I always get this sense from the men who are interviewed that they really feel a sense of responsibility to make sure that history is not lost. And I got this in this documentary in a major way, that these guys are like going, this thing just didn't happen, just like you're saying. It just didn't happen. We did this. So, I mean, is that what you found as you were approaching some of these men to talk?
Yeah, it was interesting, because there is like the larger, I guess, hesitancy to like say the wrong thing. But even within like the larger documentary context, people were highly concerned more about what their neighbors would think, actually. And like, it's a very small town. You see people on the boardwalk. Like, people were very careful, I think. And, you know, to their credit, I think we got very authentic versions of what they wanted to say still, but there was a cognizance always that they were being heard by not only, you know, people at South by Southwest, but their neighbors. And for us, it was partially, I think, trying to get people to just like forget that they're in a documentary. Like, we really embedded in that place. Like, the schedules on our shoots were insane, because it would be like, go to Scott's house, drink Margs for 2 hours so he's chill, and then do the interview until he's tired, and then we have dinner, and then we'll come back in the morning and get B-roll, and then he'll come over for Marks again, so that he feels good about what we, you know, it was very like that. And it was like, oh, you know, it was really actually difficult in the beginning, because our co-producer Joe, who's been living on the island for like 30 years, is kind of like our key to the castle a little bit, in that he set up all of our relationships and kind of like introduced everybody. But in the beginning, he got really frustrated with us, because I was like, we can't like schedule, like if we're late, it's because we're at the other person's interview who says, well, actually, before we do this interview, can we just go out to my beach? Or like, whatever, you know, and we couldn't say no. And so it was, our schedule was like, we were late all the time to everything. And people understood that a little bit, I think. But Joe, rightfully so, I think these are all his relationships, and us first coming in, then he's like, what do you mean we have to push the interview, you know, like to all these other things? Cause we were just spending so much time with these people to really feel like they could trust us and that we were peers and that, you know, we're not there just to like get the interview and go. Like, we're there to really hear your story and see who you are and try to understand who they are as people. So
yeah, something that I really love is that you do touch on the history of the place and how you want to preserve that, but it can't stay frozen in time. There will be a change of the guards. So how do people on the island feel about this next generation that they see coming to the island and partying that will one day take their place? Are they hopeful?
It's interesting. There really is a changing of the guard happening very, very, very intensely out there. And you have this generation that was out there, you know, in their formative years in the 70s and the 80s and really lived through the nightmare of AIDS, but also lived through the golden era in the 70s. And so now you have these, this new generation of us, of, you know, gay men and, you know, trans folk going out there. And, you know, we did not go through our 20s and our 30s, like watching our friends die of AIDS. And I think that there's this interesting schism out there of like, you know, that the older folks are, for a lot of them, are out there to relax and to enjoy the quiet and the peace. But the younger folks want to go out there and they want to go out and party and have a really good time and be naked and, you know, do all the party drugs and, you know, so that's kind of, is that intergenerational conflict that's very gentle, actually. It's not like really aggro. I mean, that was something that was very interesting to us in terms of like the, you know, that divide.
Yeah, and it's like both the source of joy, I think, and sort of the minor tension that does exist, because it's them basically reminiscing on what was and like really actually getting to see people live their 20s and 30s in the way that they really couldn't. And I think they really like that, and it makes them feel, you know, many of our characters have said this in the film, that there's not this intergenerational divide in terms of like people wanting to only hang out with young people. Like, there's such a cross. Like, you go to dinner parties and it's like three different generations are at the table. It's really actually quite mixed in that way. And I think the tension that exists is maybe not so much just like, you know, lifestyle dependent, but more so I think that the older generation has really fought for a long time, and they just, I think some of them are just too tired to fight more, and it needs to be the younger folks that really kind of champion that change. And when it relies on, I think, the older generation to lead that change, it can be difficult sometimes.
Yeah, they just want to paint flamingos. Sorry.
Yeah, no, no.
Paint flamingos.
Yeah, I love that guy. Let's talk about the food and being fed.
Yes.
And also, I didn't know there's food for bottoms.
Yes.
I had no idea.
It's a science. It's
I
a
was
science.
Like, oh, food for bottoms. Okay.
We
can
did
we talk about
fiber?
Right.
Fiber. Lots of lots
Send
of fiber.
Send us some recipes, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, no, they're going to do a cookbook, I'm sure.
Yeah. Actually, they're talking about like a bottom friendly cookbook.
It's a science at this point, and I think they have got it down to a science, because they cook. Like that, the thruple in the film, they cook according to like the week. Like if it's a Friday, it will be bottom friendly. If it's a Monday, it's fine. Yeah. You know.
Oh, and also like, you know, at certain times of the day, you know, there's like if you're, you know, anticipating a party or someone you're going to meet up with, you know, there's a certain sort of selection of, there's a cuisine, let's say, for those who are expecting to get some action. And then, you know, on a more relaxed day, there's things that you're allowed to eat.
Like a grilled cheese.
Like grilled cheese, yes. And fried chicken.
Yeah. Okay, so it's like training for the Olympics or a marathon. Yeah.
But it's a learning process. And it's, you know, these are time-tested, you know, like gay life hacks that are being, you know.
It's wisdom.
Exactly. It's being passed down. So
that's the intergenerational wisdom we need passed down.
But the food, really.
A lot of
amazing
information that you would not expect to get in this movie. again, the documentary is A House Is Not a Disco. We've been talking to the director, Brian J. Smith, and producer, Jeremy Truong. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We are on Bitch Talk at South by Southwest 2024. My name is John Wildman. I'm the editor-in-chief of filmsgonewild.com. With me are the Bitch Talk women, Angela Tabora and Aaron Lim. And on this segment, we're going to talk about the documentary Dickweed. We have with us the director, Jonathan Ignatius Green. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we always start this off by having our filmmaker introduce us to the film. Our audience hasn't seen it yet. Tell us about Dickweed.
It's a true crime documentary that we've been making for about 5 years. Well, we actually made it only in 1 year, but we started with the story about 5 years when I wrote a letter to a guy in prison who had a crazy heist gone wild, turns mutilation, violence, manhunt, blah, blah, blah. I don't know what else I can say.
Yeah, I think that's stop there, because even if you explain it, like, you just have to watch the film. but I wanted to talk about telling two sides of this story, because you first spoke with Hussein and got his side, but then you talked to Michael and Mary, and you have this whole other perspective. So can you talk about those two worlds and how they bring different things to the story?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, Hussein is a he's a charismatic, manipulative criminal, and so he has a compelling way to tell his side of the story, which of course includes that he's supposedly innocent. But I didn't want to, even though it's kind of a genre piece documentary, I didn't want to just have too much fun with it and not bring the reality and the horror to it. And so the way to do this is talk to the actual victims, and they were gracious enough to share their story and their perspective. And so I'm trying to take the audience on a roller coaster where they're both having fun with the crime as if it's a fiction, as if they're watching Fargo season 8, but then realizing, no, these victims actually went through this and they're still traumatized. And so hopefully those two things can live in the same movie tonally and kind of take the audience on a unique ride.
I think it was lucky that you got Michael to at least talk about his experience and trauma, not on camera, but have his voice in the film. And I wanted to ask about Courtney, Hossein's wife. Did you approach her? Did she want to be a part of the doc at all? Is she done with this story in her life?
Yes, we approached her. Of course, with her attorney present. She had done the 2020 interview back during, around the time that the trial was happening. And we had, you know, we'd been in touch with her, and then we actually got a call up with her and told her, you know, what we wanted. And yeah, she's very smart, and she's very like, there's not really any upside for me to be a part of this again, where she had a lot to gain being part of the 2020 thing. 'Cause it was actually kind of her deal with the DA that she like kind of present this certain persona publicly during the time of the trial. By the time we come to her, she's like, No thanks. But yeah, I would have loved to have gotten her perspective as well, because she was married to him for 10 years, so she knows him better than anybody else we spoke with.
I'm sure her father's like, you will not.
Yeah. Like, you exactly. Absolutely not.
Yeah, the guy who finds out from the police that she's even married to this guy.
I don't think
he's probably keen on her spreading his name around the internet any more than it already is.
Right.
The film is executive produced by the Storkels, Brian and Amy, who recently won an Emmy for Pez Outlaw. And format-wise, I would love for you to talk about, oftentimes when we're making documentaries, we either plug in stuff that we have for the story we want to tell. Sometimes we just turn the camera and start and go, where the hell is this going to take us? But when you have kind of like a pedigree, like, you know, a pair like them, they can influence it too. So I would love for you to talk about, you know, your working relationship with them and, you know, how that fed into what Dickweed wound up being.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, funny enough, Brian and I actually met Brian through a mutual friend of ours, filmmaker, back when I was first starting this story, and asked him, I showed him the deck for Dickweed and said, would you consider producing? Because I love The Legend of Cocaine Island. And it's in this kind of modality of filmmaking where it's past tense storytelling, so there's not really a lot of verite. It's interview and then recreations and then archive, if that exists, which is the kind of films I'm kind of most drawn to because of what you can do with genre and other things that I like. And so I loved his work, and I love what he did and asked him to produce. He just got off of doing Alabama Snake for HBO, and I showed him the deck for Dickweed. He's like, man, I just did a really dark movie for 2 years. He's like, I'm not really, I don't really want to do this. Funny enough, long story short, you know, fast forward 5 years later, we'd worked on three. I was an executive producer on Pez. I co-wrote and co-produced BitCon for Netflix that Brian directed. So we had started a relationship and started to collaborate, started pitching projects together. So I think we just kind of come from the same ilk in terms of the way we like to tell stories. And I think I skew a little darker than he does. He wants the more like fun stuff, which just fits our personalities. But no, I mean, they're hugely influential because they're really just great kind of guidepost of like, hey, because at one point we were just going to shoot all the interviews, for instance, and then go right into doing the recree. And I had done all the scripting and stuff. He's like, hey, I think you got to hold the phone on that. Shoot your interviews, edit the story, figure out what works, and then go shoot the recree once you know that, which is how he's really done it with Cocaine Island and Pez and all these ones. And I thought that was great advice, and it made the film a lot better because I would have shot all the wrong stuff. I'd have gone right into the recreation. So,
yeah, I'm glad you talk about your dark side, because having a career that's focused on true crime, do you find that sort of makes it hard for you to trust people, or does it make you feel better about yourself because you're not that fucked up?
I don't think either, honestly. I mean, I think I think philosophically, like, I am interested. I'm actually not. I mean, Nairi is probably the most like serial criminal person that I've pursued a story about. Usually, I'm actually more interested in the kind of everyman that steps over a line, because I think like everybody's capable of something they would probably can't believe they would do put in the right circumstances. And so, and even with him, like, you know, I'm not going to practice without a license, but he's a complex psychological person. But I don't think that he's like so far gone that he's just, you can just write him off as sociopath. And I'm just not interested in sociopath. I'm interested in people that, you know, they have that potential for a dark act within them, and at some point they get put in circumstances where they go all the way. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm comfortable with the dark side.
Again, the title of the film is Dickweed. The documentary is screening at South by Southwest, and we've been talking with Jonathan Ignatius Green. Jonathan, great having you here with us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks for joining us on today's show. You can find more information about this episode in our show notes.
If you're missing us, you can visit us at bitchtalkpodcast.com to sign up for our newsletter and buy us a cup of coffee.
Did you know we're also on the radio? You can find us at BFF.fm.
And lastly, rate and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. All the cool bitches are doing it.
This podcast is a proud member of the BFF.fm podcast network. Learn more at podcasts.bff.fm.
BFF.fm, best frequencies forever.